welcome to Gascast. After last month's maths and stats extravaganza, we're keeping it strictly clinical this episode as we all find new places to stick our ultrasound probes. We've got a new question of the month, discoveries, interviews, and possibly more if we don't run too far over in what is shaping up to be a bumper episode. I'm Rick Thomas, and joining me, as they apparently also have nothing better to do on a Friday night, are Mark Salmon.
Sorry, I didn't realize today was Friday.
I wondered
why you would say it was Friday when it wasn't. But it is. Do you want to do that again?
No, not really. I think you've already done your intro.
I think you might just say hello. Hello.
Hello.
And Frank Schneider.
Hi, everyone.
And Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
Bex, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Not bad at all.
Excellent. Nice to hear you. And what's new in the birthing fields of Toronto?
Well, my discovery of the month comes from the Society of Obstetric Anesthesia and Perinatology meeting that I was fortunate enough to go to. This was in California earlier this month. And during one of the breaks, I was cruising around the reps tables looking for some post-it notes or a free pen or something to lure me near a reps table. And I ended up in a conversation with one of the reps about spinal needles and the reason why they have stylets in. And I had always thought that the reason for having a stylet was so that when you did a lumbar puncture or a spinal, you didn't take a piece of the skin with you and then you wouldn't be able to see the CSF flowing back, so you wouldn't realize when you were in the intrathecal space. But actually, the rep told me that the reason for it is that if you have a hollow needle and you take an epidermal core, you can then transport it into the intrathecal space and leave it there, and then you'll get an iatrogenic intraspinal epidermoid tumor. So when I got home, I didn't actually believe him, and I went online, and there are actually about 30 different cases in the last 20 years about these iatrogenic tumors. And they typically develop in kids between the ages of 10 and 15. And this is usually between 7 and 10 years after they've been in either the neonatal unit or the pediatric intensive care, where you typically do lumbar punctures with hollow bore needles. So now I know the reason for having a stylet.
So is there still a significant incidence of these cases in, as you say, in the pediatric neonatal group where presumably, we still don't have needles with stylets because the bore is so small.
Yeah, those are the people who are getting them. It's mainly teenagers, and then sort of the latest is that, you know, the ages that sort of early adults, because they typically happen about 7 years after the implantation is when you get the symptoms.
That does sound like a nasty thing to have as well.
Yeah, and having just done a pediatric ITU job, done quite a lot of hollow bore lumbar punctures.
So you just need to make sure your MPS is paid up for the next 10 years at least.
Yeah.
Excellent. Moving on from that, Frank, what's new and improved in South London this month?
Well, this isn't South London. My discovery comes in two parts. I suppose most seriously has got to do with a society which I don't know if any of you are aware of, but this was at a recent Enhanced Recovery talk I went to, and there is such a thing as the ERAS Society. Now, I haven't done much work with Enhanced Recovery. I sort of vaguely know the principles about it, but these guys take it very seriously, and with good reason. They've done some incredible work. A lot of them are based in Scandinavia. They call themselves the ERAS Society, so ERAS, and the website is www.erassociety.org. And it's anyone who's got an interest in, obviously a lot of hospitals are developing these enhanced recovery or fast track programs. There's a wealth of information. I'd really recommend you have a look. And there's a lot of resources you can use if anyone is involved in setting up or refining these programs in their hospitals. But the fun part of the discovery of the month was that chewing gum, often a reasonably good cause to cancel cases when you're really not feeling like doing one, has actually got other uses in the anaesthetic field. And one of their 1A recommendations that they presented at this meeting was that chewing gum actually decreases the incidence and duration of post-operative ileus, which you may think is a minor symptom, but there's actually a significant incidence of post-operative ileus in these patients, and that obviously prevents the fast-tracking and early discharge of patients. So they actually give chewing gum to all their patients post-operatively in an effort to prevent development of postoperative ileus.
Amazing.
That's
good
so
for
cool.
your teeth and your bowel motility.
Yeah. The sugar-free stuff, of course.
Very interesting. So, Mark, are you going to be keeping it clinical or let the side down and be aptastic?
Neither. As you well know, Rick, most of my best medical revision is done by watching TV. So I'm going to recommend a TV program, mainly because there's a fair chance I'm going to be on it. And the program is called 24 Hours in A&E, Channel 4 on Wednesday evenings at 9 o'clock, which does unfortunately clash with The Apprentice, but that's why God invented Sky Plus. And yeah, it's a fly on the wall documentary based around the A&E department at King's College Hospital in London. And if you are excited by men in red or orange flight suits, as I am,
yeah, which we all are,
then
speak for yourselves.
It's a nice documentary, and it counts as revision, even though it's telly.
Fantastic, fantastic.
Did you have a hair and makeup before the shoot?
No, and they shot continuously for weeks, and so you
can't always look your best, can you?
No, one time they filmed me, I was wearing a hat the whole time, so I'm not looking forward to seeing that. No, I don't know if I'm going to be on, but either way, they show some good trauma cases and some good fly on the wall stuff about working A&E. And
so, did you have to sign a non-disclosure agreement or a release,
yep,
or whatever it is you need to sign?
I signed something, yeah. Who knows what it was?
Channel 4 now own your soul.
Yeah.
And you will be appearing on the next Celebrity Big Brother.
So I've got two discoveries this month. The first one is that I am truly awful at anaesthetics.
It took you till now to figure it out.
I know.
A new discovery.
It's a discovery. I'm pretty sure that I used to be at the very least passably mediocre. But after a year and 3 months doing research in ITU, I've discovered that I am now completely shocking. Ampules are literally exploding in my indelicate mitts. Whenever I draw up profile, it looks like a milkshake and I spill it everywhere. And I am always leaving the vaporizer on in the anesthetic room and getting a slap on the wrist from the ODP. It's actually quite depressing and is rapidly becoming expensive for the trust I work in. So this month, I've discovered that giving anaesthetics is nothing like riding a bike. So yeah, it has been slightly disheartening from that point of view, although it is great to be back in theatres. My second discovery is a pre-recorded piece, so I think we'll do that a little later in the episode, if that's all right.
Yeah, it's kind of worrying. I'm drawing to the end of a year off regular anaesthetics, and that's not done anything to help my fear of returning to theatres.
Yes, look forward to feeling like a novice SHO once again.
Have you sprayed yourself with kefiroxime yet?
No, I haven't done that, so I haven't had that horrible cat's pee smell,
yeah,
when I go home. No, not yet. But I've sprayed pretty much everybody else with everything else I could possibly find. It really has been quite embarrassing. Using my bad anaesthetic skills as a comparable clumsy segue, I'm going to be aiming to improve them by attending this year's GAT ASM at the end of June. June is going to mark GASCAST's 1 year anniversary, and we're celebrating by doing a special GATcast from the conference. Mark and I are definitely going to be there, and we're trying very hard to persuade Frank that his on-call commitments aren't really as important as his hospital is making out. The programme for the conference looks great, and I'm sure we'll manage to catch up with a few of the speakers for some sound bites for the episode. I'm particularly looking forward to listening to Kenny Bailey talk, a guy who manages to combine anaesthetics, ICU, with altitude and genetic research. Sure to be fascinating, and I'm definitely going to ask him how you go about getting a job that cool. More on GAT later in this episode, but if you're wavering on whether or not to go, do it. It's bound to be both educationally and socially awesome.
Where is GAT this year?
It's in Glasgow. Kicking off with our ultrasound discoveries, Mark, you have been using ultrasound to look into people's chests, I believe.
I have been, and now I have some evidence-based recommendations to guide me when I do so. I'm talking, of course, about a conference report published in Intensive Care Medicine this month, whereby a group of experts have sat around, reviewed the evidence, and published a whole list of statements regarding the evidence. I first got interested in this piece because I recently went to a consensus meeting, and it did strike me at the time that it was less international experts and more just whoever could be bothered to turn up on the day and give their opinion. I will, of course, not be naming the consensus.
Because you would one day like to be one of them.
Well, I was one of them. but however, this paper seems to take itself a lot more seriously and goes to great lengths to explain the credentials of the experts. They had 28 international experts who were only accepted after stringent trial by Medline. They had to have published themselves works in this field and prove their worth. And they sat down in several meetings and looked at around 320 references in order to consider 73 different statements. After all of this, they managed to come up with strong recommendations for 65 of the statements, looking at all sorts of uses for lung ultrasound. I mainly want to talk about pneumothorax, because that's what I use it for, and a little bit about pleural effusions. To summarize the recommendations they make for lung ultrasound for pneumothorax, what they're saying is there is strong evidence for looking for the following signs of pneumothorax ultrasound, and those four key signs are lung sliding, which is the kind of rippling appearance you get as the parietal and visceral pleura slide against each other. You also get B-lines or comet tails, which are a kind of vertical artifact that'll shoot from the pleura right down into the tissue of the lung. Thirdly, lung point is often where you can see the edge of a pneumothorax sliding in and out of view. And fourthly, the lung pulse, which is a transmitted pulsation from the heart. So there is strong level A evidence that those are the signs to look for. Other key things they recommend are that we start at the least gravitationally dependent area and progress laterally. So usually on a supine patient, that's going to be front to back. They mention that M-mode and color Doppler are useful adjuncts. In summary, that lung ultrasound for pneumothorax is better than a supine chest x-ray at ruling pneumothorax in or out. However, there was no consensus about it, whether it's better than CT or whether it's any good at differentiating between large and small pneumothoraces. Any questions so far?
Well, I think one of the benefits as well is that it's better than a chest x-ray in supine patients, in typical ITU patients.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's not dependent on where the air is collecting, and you're supposed to be able to pick it up easier. I don't know, so I know you're interested in this, is that, but you guys aren't flying around with portable ultrasounds at the moment, are you?
Yes, we are.
Oh, are you?
Yep.
I'll take it all back. That's where all our taxpayer money goes to.
It's good. It's something I want to be better at, because I'm still a little sceptical about how useful it is, in that if I'm going to treat a pneumothorax in a trauma patient, it's going to be because it's having physiological consequences, and therefore it's a clinical diagnosis. Similarly, there's many cases I do where I'm aware that the patient probably has a pneumothorax, but I won't act on it because they're not physiologically compromised, other than maybe to warn the hospital I'm coming to that the patient may need a fairly rapid chest intervention. So I guess...
Hang on, but knowing they've got a pneumothorax, you nevertheless jump into a helicopter with them?
Well, I suppose...
Only after doing thoracostomies.
Well, not necessarily. This is where the job gets difficult. I had a case recently where a patient definitely had rib fractures and a pneumothorax, but didn't necessarily need an intervention immediately. No indication for intubation, and therefore you have to decide, are you going to treat it preemptively with all the negative effects of, you know, doing a chest drain on the roadside, or do you take them to hospital and have them treated there. And as you say, Rick, flying somebody awake with a pneumothorax is a big decision, because you've got to be confident that it's not going to get worse. And so I suppose it may influence your management in that you might consider a land transfer in those cases. But then again, the example I'm talking about was a clinical diagnosis of a pneumothorax that was so obvious that I didn't use the ultrasound. So it's really useful, I suppose, if you've got some suspicion but can't detect anything clinically. I waver as to whether or not it's we like to know for academic interest because we like to know, or whether I can't think of that many examples when it's actually changed my decision in the field.
As part of our trauma call in our major trauma centre, we have a radiology reg come along with an ultrasound and do, you know, the necessary scans, and their pickup rate on pneumothoraces is phenomenal. You know, they straight on the chest, it's much quicker than an x-ray. They'll tell you there and then whether or not there's anything to worry about.
It's a good rule out if somebody's got, you know, a fractured clavicle or ribs and you think that there's a very high chance they've got a pneumothorax. It's reassuring to rule it out.
I think it's quite good, even if you don't act on it, that you know it's there, so that if they deteriorate, that would be your first thing to eliminate, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
And obviously you're not able to auscultate, certainly in flight.
No.
Or even on the roadside sometimes.
Yeah,
it's a less useful skill, although I do carry a stethoscope.
What, just because it looks cool with your red flight suit?
So, reading these recommendations, I didn't know much about the lung pulsing sign before, and through reading this and YouTube, I like to think I'm getting better at doing these scans. Similarly, looking for effusions, which in my current line of work are almost always going to be hemothoraces. The recommendations are fairly similar. They reckon that both of the following signs are almost always present, that being a space between the parietal and visceral pleura and respiratory movement of the lung within the effusion. So in my language, you've got a big black gap and the lung kind of comes in and out.
And hope we'll be putting your favourite YouTube videos on the podcast notes.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much, Mark. So before we move on to Frank, I want to introduce a new feature, which I'm imaginatively calling the Gascast Poll. So for those of you who went to the website before downloading, you'll see that I've managed to add a very simple poll feature to the blog. Every month, we're going to ask a question, and hopefully you'll go to the website at some point, click, and vote. And this month's poll question is, how do you feel about emails for SurveyMonkey polls? Excited, indifferent, or filled with rage?
Can we have another one beyond filled with rage?
No, I think that's the one Mark's going to want to tick there.
No, actually, so this month I would like to use the poll as our premier poll to help me crowdsource some data for a bit of clinical research I'm trying to do. Most people have probably worked nights covering the wards for pain calls or been on a labour ward where this hopefully familiar scenario has occurred. So this is it. You're called to see a patient with an epidural who is in pain, and on inspection it becomes clear that the epidural has become disconnected proximal to the filter, i.e. the free non-sterile end has been rubbing against the patient's sweaty back and bedsheets. This is an unwitnessed disconnection and the patient is now in pain. So on the poll there is, do you 1. Simply reconnect, give a bolus and continue the infusion. 2. Wipe the distal 5 to 10 centimetres of the catheter with a sterette, snip it with some sterile scissors, reconnect, give a bolus and continue the infusion. 3. Pull it out if it is safe to do so from an anticoagulation point of view, and then start a PCA or another route of analgesia. Or 4. Do something else. If you would do something else and have the time, please use the Contact Us page to drop me a quick note and to say what that is. So that's it, very simple. Please go to the website, just give us a quick click, 1 vote please, and we'll announce the results next month.
I think you need to clarify whether anyone else is watching you or not, and how tired you are.
What you would admit to. Was the court of law.
Rick, was there no option there for reciting a whole new epidural?
That's the other.
Oh, interesting. Okay, right, I will add that.
Yeah, because that's what I would do, I think, in that circumstance.
What, seriously, in the middle really? Of the night you would recite a new epidural?
Are we on record here?
Yeah, who's listening? Is the AAGBI still here?
Why, Mark?
Yes, Dr. Yentis, of course I would start again from scratch in a sterile environment.
I would wheel the patient round to theatres myself. Pay for my ODP to come in via taxi.
No, I will vote anonymously on the website like everybody else, Rick, rather than air my laundry here.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
that's
likewise.
All I ask. So, Frank, you have got some more to say on chest ultrasound, I believe.
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, I also was going to speak about lung ultrasound, and I know Mark doesn't get too excited about this. The reason it came to my attention was that in the cardiothoracic intensive care unit that at the hospital I'm currently working at, some of the intensivists are looking at lung ultrasound, and specifically Mark mentioned the ultrasound lung comets or comet tails as a sign of extravascular lung water. And this is sometimes called the alveolar interstitial syndrome, and obviously can have a number of causes, but I hadn't really heard much about using ultrasound to assess the severity of essentially fluid in the interstitial spaces in the lungs. And I think most of us, or I suspect most of us, have played around with the ultrasound machine, and obviously there are bits of kit that are more and more prevalent in ITUs, certainly, and in theatres. And in my last sort of rotations through intensive care, I've certainly used it before putting chest drains in and had a look around to see if you can assess the size of effusions and so on. And I hadn't really looked at any of the markings. But if you look at the literature, this has actually been quite well defined, and certainly these a couple of articles we can link to from the website are going back to sort of early 2000, and obviously the review article that Mark mentioned has just really been in the consensus group of some of the indications and recommendations. Ultrasound lung comets really are just an echo sign that you can use with an ultrasound probe, and I suppose because there's a lot of different equipment out there, you can either use a cardiac probe or even just a linear probe. And what it allows you to do is it shows, I mean, they are caused by artifact, but they originate from water-thickened interlobular septa and the pleural line, which is hyperechoic. And it just it causes a reverberation effect, which then appears as comet tails. And if you've seen, it's difficult to explain without visual aid. So if you have a look at, or if you Google it, or have a look at the articles we link to, they have a particular appearance. And once you've seen them, they're quite easy to then pick up. What the article talks about is using that as a sign to quantify the extent of alveolar interstitial syndrome, and obviously that can be due to failure, heart failure, fluid overload, anything that causes pulmonary edema, but also obviously pulmonary fibrosis or other interstitial changes. And there's a number of different ways of doing it, but the consensus statement suggests just looking at 8 areas. There's a more comprehensive model which looks at 26 or even 30 areas around the lung, and essentially if you have a certain number, and again that varies, of these comet tails or beelines, then that would indicate a significant amount of water. The reason the cardiac unit I'm working at is looking at it is because you can actually use it as a measure of response to treatment. So someone who does have fluid overload or a degree of failure, you do something about it, and then you can scan again in 6 or 12 hours and see what effect that's had and whether there's less of these ultrasound findings. And they correlate essentially to curly B lines on chest x-rays. But obviously the benefit, and we've mentioned some of these already, is that you don't expose someone to radiation, you don't have to arrange or wait for a chest x-ray to be arranged. And it's a technique that's easily picked up, and the equipment is usually available on every intensive care unit. Now, the only other, so obviously chest x-rays are one way of quantifying it. The only other way of doing it is, I don't know who of you have used, well, I know Mark, you and I have used PICO lines on one intensive care unit at least, but obviously PICO lines are the only sort of invasive monitoring system which does, as far as I know, does allow measurement of extravascular lung water, and that is the same sort of indication as these ultrasound findings. And they, in one of these papers, actually found a good correlation between both chest X-ray findings as well as extravascular lung water measurements with well, they don't mention that it's a PICO line, but that certainly sounds what they're describing. So there seems to be good correlation with the other ways we have of measuring extravascular lung water, and I think it's just something worth keeping in mind next time you have a patient whom you're trying to establish whether or not there may be a degree of failure or pulmonary edema or even consolidation with interstitial infiltration. And again, if you look at the consensus statement that Mark mentioned, they also specifically talk about the differences between AIS and consolidation with pneumonias and other lung problems, and that's probably worth looking at if you are interested in it. There's some physics behind it, which Rick will probably get excited about, but again, I don't want to focus on that. Anyone who is interested, these articles are easy to find on the internet, and I would suggest you just go and have a look at that.
So fantastic. You can now follow up your furosemide challenge with an ultrasound confirmation that it's made no difference to overall outcome.
But the point is that it's so quick, isn't it? Because they said it takes someone who's trained in it can do the scanning in 3 minutes or less, compared to the amount of time it takes when you admit a patient to ITU and they're unstable and you're not sure of their volume status, and then takes you, you know, an hour to get the arc line in and get the lid co-calibrated, or, you know, whatever invasive monitoring you're going to use. This is something that you could just use almost instantaneously to just help you guide that first hour.
You said you and Mark have both used a PICO. I've used a PICO extensively for the last year and I love it. It's my favourite invasive magic monitor.
It is probably the geekiest of the monitors out there, so I'm not surprised, Rick.
Yeah, but I do enjoy it. It's a shame it has to have its own special arterial catheter, but it is it gives you so much information. I love that clinical decision model thing it gives you as well. I keep meaning to look up exactly how the physics and technology behind a PICO works, so I don't understand it at all. But the fact it tells me how wet the lungs are is just brilliant.
Yeah.
But it would be great to be able to just plonk on an ultrasound probe, as you say, and give you a non-invasive, you know, operator, relatively independent, requires some skill, but gives you a figure or at least an inclination of what you need to do.
Well, I think it's certainly worth, next time you're near a chest with an ultrasound machine, you know, even if you're pre-scanning for lines or whatever, but don't be alarmed if you are, because I've been scanning my lung and my subclavian in preparation for this podcast and I couldn't find any, but you can find a couple that are just normal normal variants, or you're allowed a couple.
Yeah, less than anything, 5, I think. And
yeah, anything more than 5, I think you should just up your dose of furosemide.
And as I say, I rely on them to rule out pneumothoraces, so it's good to see a few. You need that intact interface between the two layers of pleura, so if you can't see any at all, then you may well have a pneumothorax.
Thanks very much for that, Frank. This is probably a good time to do my second discovery in a feature I'm going to also call, after your comment last month, Frank, "Look Who's Stalking Now." Following up from last month's research fraud episode, after a few emails and a conveniently placed set of nights, I'm actually in the coffee room in the Royal College and joined by John Carlisle.
Afternoon.
John, thanks very much for getting in touch. Welcome to Gascast and congratulations once again on an astounding piece of work.
You're very, very kind, Rick. Thank you very much.
So, tell me, how long did it take you to realise that Dr. Fuji's data was suspect, and how long did it take you to actually prove it?
So, I guess the story goes back for me to about 2002, so 10 years ago, when, as an editor of the Cochrane collaboration, I was asked to do a review because I'd been editing other people's. And they suggested I do one on postoperative nausea and vomiting, which had become available because the original author had gone on maternity leave. So I took that on, and obviously Dr. Fuji's data comprised a significant proportion of studies, particularly on granisetron. And in the process of going through his data, I noticed the similarity of a lot of the rates of headache and other outcomes from the papers. And so I ended up reading the letter that Dr. Cranker had published in 2000. So I guess it would be about 2003, 2004 when I first realised something may be amiss. I even showed the data to a statistician in Oxford who actually said fairly frankly that he didn't really need any stats to show that there's something wrong with these data. All you needed to do was look at them.
What do you think would motivate someone to falsify a data set, and certainly so many data sets, into this kind of degree?
Well, obviously, this is a question which people have been asking themselves, particularly anaesthetics, with Bolt and Rubin and Dr. Fuji. And it's a wider general concern in the scientific community about, well, why would somebody really put a lot of their professional career on the line, and should somebody be found guilty of fraud of one sort or another, it has knock-on consequences for their general life and their family and all sorts. I can only guess, but I imagine there's something appealing about seeing your name in print, about publishing large volumes of data. There's a competitive edge to it. Perhaps there's a slight narcissistic side of it, and you see yourself in the headlines. It's also very difficult to do randomised controlled trials. I've only been personally involved in two, and I've been a consultant for 10 years. They're very time-consuming, and it must be quicker, to a degree, if you're good at it and stick at it, to make up data than it is to actually do the hard work yourself.
But of course, as you mentioned, it's not just the effect that it would have potentially on a scientist's life if they got caught doing all this. Mm. In medicine, there's a more serious issue here of distorting a large data set on which people rely, especially if your work tends to, as it does, gravitate to one particular question.
Mm. So the consequences of, as you correctly termed it, the data set being contaminated by dodgy data will vary from one thing to another. In this particular case, you might consider that the results of a meta-analysis including Fuji's data leads to one thinking that crinisotron has a greater effect than if you exclude his data. So you might be tempted to buy crinisotron for your patients and use it preference to other cheaper antiemetics. And because whilst on licence, any new antiemetic and crinisotron has been one of the newer ones, although I think it's off licence now, it was 10 times more expensive than other ones. So an indirect consequence might be you'd actually end up giving antiemetics to fewer patients because of its expense. So given that postoperative nausea and vomiting, although it's a fairly boring outcome, is one perhaps most feared by your average patient before they go ahead and have an anaesthetic and surgery, it's of considerable interest to patients whether they are offered antiemetics and whether their risk is minimised.
There's been a lot of research fraud reported of late. Do you think we've got all the bad guys, or is this in fact just the tip of a huge and alarming iceberg?
That exact phrase has been used by, of it potentially being a tip of an iceberg, has been used by an editor-in-chief of a journal, and I think everyone is worried. Certainly everyone's confident that we don't have a good handle on how big a problem this is. And I anticipate that some thorough trawling through studies that have been done to date will show a fairly consistent proportion have data that looks to be made up. But your guess is as good as mine as to what proportion of the data it is.
In the last episode, Frank asked me if there was a way for journals to check authors' data in the same sort of manner that Authenticate works. I thought that probably given the huge variety of data types and requirement for reasonable sample sizes, this was going to be very difficult to do. But do you think this is correct, or could your methods, or ones similar to the ones you've used, be eventually written into an automated process that would help editors decide what was a bit suspect and what wasn't?
Yeah, well, Rick, you anticipated a little bit of what we've been doing. although I'm not aware of any journal doing it consistently for every single paper submitted, the method I use, particularly for continuous variables, has been applied to a couple of papers submitted to a couple of journals since, and it has raised questions about those particular papers. The software can be programmed, it's very easy, you can do it in Excel or any other type of spreadsheet function. You could put it online, and that's something I'm actually working on at the moment, for anybody to use freely. All you need, as the person putting in the data, you don't need to necessarily understand the background mechanics of what's going on, but all you need to do is put in a mean, a standard deviation, and the number in a group. And there's a couple of other simple variables, but it'd be very easy to just have a front sheet where people could just input data, and then it will churn out maybe some graphs, and so you can see what the data looks like, and then get some p-values associated with their distribution. So no, I think it could very easily be automated.
Obviously, in the letter from the 22 journal editors to Dr. Fuji's previous employers, they've asked for his original data set. What's your view on open data and making submission of data sets for the scientific record a way to go forward with scientific publications?
So generally, for most studies, I think that's the right thing to do. And just as you suggested in edition 10, GrassCast, I think it would generally be a good idea for people to submit their raw data for analysis. And certainly, in a follow-up paper that we'll publish at some point in the future on the analysis technique that we used, we'll publish online that data for people to have a look at and really check that we've done our calculations correctly. And I think it's sensible that people who are generating original studies could also do that, both for data verification purposes and, as you suggested, also for looking at analyses that people, the original authors, had not necessarily thought about doing.
Final question, just for the nerds listening. What's your favourite statistical program or stats program of choice?
Listeners, Rick had given me a preview of the questions he's going to ask me, and this one I was dreading the most because I'm really going to be a standard statistical nerd now. I use Stata, which is a very expensive program to buy from the US. It comes with loads of books, which I ended up reading a fair proportion of, but only really in response to people in my hospital asking me to do bits of stats, which I didn't really know how to do, so I had to read them up, and also little projects that I was doing. I would like to know how to use R because it's free, but I haven't got round to working out how to use it, but I know a couple of anesthetic editors who do use R. I used to use SPSS, when I could get a free version, but I can't anymore.
Brilliant. John, thank you very much for joining us, and hopefully we can have you back on in the future. We've got a bit more news on this story.
Yeah, thanks very much for inviting me to GrassCast Studios.
Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Nice interview, by the way.
Yeah, he seems very nice.
I like the authentic cups rattling in the background.
Yeah, that wasn't just a soundtrack, was it?
Yeah, it was authentic because we really were in the...
I know, but it's just nice that someone else is having tea while they're doing this instead of just me usually off to make boil the kettle.
No, it was really cool. He was absolutely delightful. What is interesting is, do you know how he found out about us?
About us?
So he's not someone who listens to the podcast regularly or has ever heard of it. But he sits there at night Googling... Not every night, but he sits there Googling Dr. Fuji because obviously he needs to keep up with what's going on.
Oh, yeah.
And we actually, and we came up on a Google search.
That's so cool.
On about page 4. So we came up with us and Dr. Fuji and him on a Google search. So he went to the website, downloaded the episode, had a listen, and then sent me an email.
I thought you'd stalked him.
No, I genuinely
didn't. We've been
approached.
No one's going to believe you, Rick.
No, this is genuinely true, and I've got more for this as well. He sent me an email and said, you know, I liked your thing, very nice, would like to meet up and have a chat, hence we did, which, you know, you've all just heard. That's how the whole thing came about, but as we said at the end of the interview, there's going to be more to this story when the University of Toho and Dr. Fuji's other employers will hopefully answer this letter from the 22 anesthetic journal editors. And we may well record an episode with John in the future.
Excellent.
He was really keen. I said, how do you feel about maybe coming and doing an episode with us after there's some more in this story? And he said, yeah, that'd be great. And he'd be really into it. So that is something to look forward to for the future.
Sweet.
So basically, the two of you can talk statistics to each other, can't you?
Yeah. You don't, you can look bored because he won't see your backs.
I'll be leading the discussion.
So that's that, and we should move on to my article, which I'm going to start with a little story. I'm sure this is a familiar scenario. You're on a day case gynae list when into the anaesthetic room come a couple of medical students on their ONG attachment, and they're asking, can we observe the anaesthetic? Of course, they're more than welcome to stay, whilst in under 30 seconds you condense one of the more difficult postgraduate exams into big syringe, little syringe, sex toy on a stick, followed by 15 minutes of observer-perceived relative inattention. Within a short space of time comes the inevitable question, why did you want to be an anaesthetist? For me, like many anaesthetists, I was quite slow to pick my specialty. I remember sitting with my surgical consultant post-house jobs, having the pre-MMC, I'll sign you off because you turned up to work and managed not to kill anyone chat, when he asked what I wanted to do long-term. Throughout my six-month attachment, I'd managed to nurture a pathological hatred for my surgical registrar and a bit of a talent for cannulation. My consultant and I discussed what I could possibly do within the hospital environment, and it was decided that given my animosity towards surgeons and that I was good at Venflons, a career in anaesthesia would probably be most appropriate. And what I reckon is around 10,000 Venflons later, I do still enjoy a good Venflon. I recently reread the piece in Anaesthesia News from 2003 regarding the inaugural meeting of the Tricky Vein Society. This would definitely be one of the specialist societies I would gladly pay a subscription fee to. I'll put a link on the website. As anaesthetist, central venous access remains a core skill, and in addition to the tricky Venflon calls from the wards, in many hospitals I have worked at in the last few years, we are quite reasonably, in my opinion, expected to assist with central venous access issues. I started anaesthetics well after the 2002 NICE guidance regarding the use of ultrasound for jugular line placement, and as a result, I've learnt to place IJ lines with real-time ultrasound from day one. I had a quick check of my logbook this afternoon, and I've clocked over 400 IJ lines, the majority of which have been ultrasound guided. There's no doubt that it reduces complications, improves speed, and probably saves money. Again, there's a really nice editorial in the BGA from 2002 that we'll link to that nicely summarises the prevailing attitudes towards ultrasound at the time of the original NICE guidance. The only negative effect from the ease of ultrasound-guided IJ lines has been the relative decline of the subclavian line. Before ultrasound guidance, IJ and subclavian lines had a comparable complication rate, many consultants preferring subclavian lines as a first choice of central access, citing the greater anatomical consistency as a factor increasing first-time success rates. Even today, the NHS Patient Safety First website still recommends subclavian as the first route of access from an infection control point of view, referring to two papers, one in JAMA and one in Critical Care Medicine. The problem is that nowadays, due to the ease of IJ placement, the subclavian route is only generally thought about after other routes have been exhausted. On ITU, I occasionally find myself in the unenviable position of being the backup line man after traditional ultrasound-guided routes have been exhausted or deemed not appropriate. I'm often then forced into attempting a blind technique that I'm not as familiar with. I don't think my complication rate from subclavian lines is unacceptable, but it is definitely higher than my rate from IJ lines. What I have always wanted is an ultrasound-guided technique, but I have never come across anyone who does them. The consultants who taught me subclavian lines were all well-versed in the landmark technique, and as the subclavian route has become a less frequently used backup, there is even less incentive for them to learn a new technique for an occasionally used procedure. I was thrilled when I came across the paper I'm going to mention in Critical Care Medicine in July last year. A group in Greece conducted a prospective randomised controlled trial looking at ultrasound-guided subclavian versus landmark technique with good numbers, 200 in each group. The ultrasound technique they used was a long-axis infraclavicular view backed up with Doppler conformation. Although they have good quality pictures in the article, being a dynamic technique, it doesn't really demonstrate the procedure. However, I have managed to find an excellent YouTube clip from Sonocyte, purveyor of such excellent video content as the rehabilitator we mentioned on the World Congress episode. which we will link to. That video is, however, demonstrating a transverse technique, which is not quite the same as the one in the paper, but a neat demonstration nonetheless. It's definitely more fiddly than IJ ultrasound, but I have done some practice, and whilst I haven't had a chance to try it, I reckon for those used to doing transverse IJs, it shouldn't be too tricky. As the YouTube video demonstrates, you place the probe perpendicular and straddling the clavicle, so roughly half on and half off. You should get an image that is largely taken up by the acoustic shadow of the clavicle, but with a bit of manoeuvring medially and laterally, you should be able to pick up the axillary vein and artery just before they disappear under the clavicle to form the subclavian proper. The problem is that unlike IJ access, you can't easily compress the vein to confirm that you are not about to roger the wrong vessel. However, with the majority of modern machines, it is pretty simple to use a pulsed wave Doppler on the two vessels and pick up a good audible pulsation from the artery. This step, I think, is pretty crucial, and whilst they mention it in the paper when describing their technique, they've reduced it to one sentence. If you're not familiar with pulsed wave Doppler, it is basically a normal Doppler signal that is confined to a specific anatomical location on the 2D image on the screen. You can normally convert the waveform to an audible signal just like you get with an esophageal Doppler. I was on nights this week and got stuck in theatre babysitting a patient for a couple of hours whilst waiting for an ITU bed, during which time I managed to convincingly locate the subclavian vein on the patient, myself, and any member of staff that volunteered to relieve me for breaks. As I said, I've not yet actually attempted to place a line using this method, but initial impressions look good. In the paper, they found that with ultrasound guidance, they had a serious complication rate of between 5 and 10%, which is pretty vast. These are things like pneumothorax, hemothorax, and tamponade, and is a figure which, whilst being high, does fit with my observations of my own and others' practice. Success rate via a landmark technique was 87.5% with an average of 2 attempts. By contrast, ultrasound guidance had a success rate of 100% with an average number of attempts of 1. As you would expect, complication rate was significantly lower for all complications, with only one instance of arterial puncture. The only complication that had the same rate in both groups was catheter misplacement, although in the ultrasound group this was detected and repositioned with the use of ultrasound. One aspect that I think is really important, and not as highlighted as it should be, is the relationship between number of attempts and infection. NAP3 identified multiple attempts as a risk factor for epidural catheter infection, and it makes intuitive sense that with multiple attempts, increased operator anxiety and desperation, the first thing to be compromised is sterile technique. Reducing the number of attempts and increasing operator confidence can only, in my book, lead to improved sterile technique, meaning the line you've worked so hard to get in won't get removed 3 days later for a site infection. The only downside in the paper was the predictable factor of complexity, with participating physicians rating the procedure as technically difficult. From now on, when faced with a subclavian line, I will certainly be reaching for the ultrasound and trying to modify my landmark technique to increase safety, sterility, and reduce complication rates. I think it's possible, and I'd be keen to hear about anybody who uses the technique every day.
I've never used it.
I thought it was an interesting article, Rick, because I do... When I can, I do subclavian lines, and probably I had a look through my logbook as well, and about a third of my lines over the last 2 years have been subclavians. And I suppose the only reason I haven't used an ultrasound or thought of it was because I did have a look with the ultrasound when we started using them for internal jugular lines, and I suppose I hadn't really used the technique they describe in this paper, but certainly in my hands, I couldn't really get a real-time image that I thought was of any use when trying to put it in. And to be honest, I'd had quite a lot of experience putting subclavian lines in with a landmark technique. And now, having read this paper, I think I am slightly more apprehensive because I haven't had that many complications that I know of. But I think the scary ones they mention here are things like brachial plexus injuries and phrenic nerve injuries, for that matter. Which, although are rare, I mean, the numbers they quote are quite high, and I had to look it up because, I mean, the numbers they quote are reasonably widely quoted in the literature, and it just does seem a bit scary that...
I had the same concerns, Frank, and I looked at it, but I found published references to there normally being a mechanical complication rate of kind of 15 to 19%, but these guys in this study have a complication rate of 36% in the landmark group, which... does make me wonder if they're so used to doing them in the ultrasound group, they might have you know,
not being as good with
not
with
being
a
as
landmark.
Good at landmark, and that's what's made their results look better.
I think that complication rate though that you just quoted in the 30s does include catheter misplacement.
Oh, that's true.
So yep. if you take that out, it goes down to about 10 or 15.
Well, no,
seems reasonable.
The catheter placement is 11%, so that still leaves them with a 25% complication rate for the other stuff. So on the high side.
Also, catheter misplacement does muddy the waters a bit because that isn't prevented by use of ultrasound. Although, they did say, obviously... Anyway, I did find their technique a bit cumbersome, the fact that they would sterilise the other side as well, and then be... it is the right thing to do, but...
Yeah.
But, it does add on quite a lot of time, I would have thought, to your procedure, if you're sterilising the other side, so that if your catheter is misplaced, you can then do something about it right away.
But from their... No, but their article, it says that they have... fewer attempts and a shorter duration of time in the ultrasound group. So obviously they must be quite slick, even if they are... Or do you mean actually the preparation would be increasing your length of time?
The access time is just from skin puncture to vein puncture. So they mention a couple of extra minutes added for scanning the area, but they don't mention the actual setup time. They do say that it takes considerably longer... the preparation, but I think you're probably right, Bex. I think that's outweighed by the average number of attempts is 1.1 for ultrasound and 1.9 without. So it means they're almost always doing it twice in the landmark technique.
And I suppose my only reservation is that, I think whenever you're trying a new technique, do you think you have to be careful? I mean, they do mention, because I was interested to know, because they don't comment on where their sort of insertion site or puncture site is, but they just talk about how that varies with the operator and visualization on that particular patient. But I think you do need to be reasonably confident with the ultrasound. I mean, these were all experienced operators who still managed to score an 8 out of 10 in terms of complexity. And given that there's not, certainly in the places we've worked, probably there's not that many people that are competent to use ultrasound for subclavian lines. I think you do just have to, and I certainly am going to start using ultrasound, or certainly having a look before putting a subclavian line in now. But I think you do need to be quite cautious about using it and thinking that you're going to be able to replicate the good numbers with an ultrasound technique.
I completely agree with you. What I'm going to have to do is I'm going to have to use the landmark technique which I've been taught and use, and I'm going to augment that with ultrasound until I've altered my technique to a time when it is a real a real-time ultrasound technique. Which the YouTube video I'm going to link to, which uses this transverse approach with the over the subclavian, it looks really good.
It does look easy. I'm with Frank. I'm already ultrasounding a lot of chests anyway with the appropriate kind of probe and in the right kind of areas, so I'm going to start looking for this vein in the hope that if I need to use one anytime soon, I'll have had some experience at looking at it.
And I think if you can start using ultrasound, well, a couple of comments there. I think the longitudinal view would be great to become proficient at, because I think that's more useful in transverse. And I think if you can become competent and do it as well as these guys seem to be able to do it, wouldn't it be great to be able to say that you can safely do a subclavian, or as safely as an internal jugular? Because I do think it is a better line, just in terms of infection
control.
It's
definitely, I completely agree management. It's a much better line. Management, sterility, patient comfort, it's absolutely fantastic. But the key is being able to drop a Doppler. Because you can't compress it. You need to be able to look at that waveform and see a venous pulsation, and then also to be able to identify the subclavian or axillary artery, see an arterial waveform on it, so you know what you're about to hit or try to avoid, as the case may be.
Yeah,
definitely worth looking into. I, as I said earlier, carry ultrasound pre-hospital, and every now and again I've used it for central line placement where IV access has been difficult in small children, and usually have to go for the femoral. The neck, for obvious reasons, is out of bounds with a collar on usually, and is difficult to control. But I think there are lots of reasons why a good subclavian line would be easily accessible and easy to stick down and keep an eye on. So I'm definitely going to be, as I say, trying to find the vein in my next few patients so that if I need to use one, I can give it a go.
Well, no, I'll just shall we just do a straw poll? I mean, who does subclavian lines regularly out of us?
No.
No.
They're unusual in general in obstetrics, and subclavian even more so.
So were you not weaned on subclavian lines in South Africa?
Yeah, yeah. So like a decade ago, I did a lot of them.
Okay.
I'm sure I've de-skilled sufficiently.
No, I've only done a handful, and unfortunately, as Rick said, they're often when there's a reason not to go for the neck, so not nearly enough.
But I think that's just a culture, isn't it? And it should shift and it should change, because if you can have an equivalent complication rate and a lower infection rate, then that should be the vein of choice.
Mark, so tell us, what happened with last month's question?
Well, this was fascinating. I asked something about loading up a helicopter with people and flying from the Royal London, and how long would it take, or how far would we get before we ran out of fuel and crashed. And we do have a winner, a person I know only as Rick, who's replied via our website with two impressively detailed possible answers. Extremely precisely locating our wreckage on a road called the D47 between Saint-Julie-le-Fausson and Le Ménil-Mausset in northern France. Way more detail than I'd ever anticipated. I would have accepted France as an answer, but there we go.
This isn't Rick Thomas trying to hang on to copies of his book.
They're flying off the shelves at a worrying rate. No, it seems to be Rick with a C. If we get more details from Rick...
Do you think Rick, he's French? Rick?
He's emailed from Manchester, I think, so maybe not.
Probably not.
But either way, if we get some more personal details from Rick, he can be the proud winner of a fascinating physics in anesthesia textbook.
So, yeah, well done, Rick Cohen. So please send us your address, and a physics book will be on its way to you if you would like. So for this month's question, we're offering two prizes.
We'll do
the usual book. Yep, two prizes. We'll do the usual book for the first correct answer. But if you work out the answer and are attending the Gatasm in Glasgow, that's what I'm calling it. Is it working?
Yeah, it's good.
I like it.
But if you are attending the Gatasm, come and find one of us at the Happy Hour event on the Wednesday evening. And if you are indeed correct, we will buy you a drink. If you are wrong, however, I think it's only fair that you have to buy us a drink. What do you guys reckon?
Definitely.
Yeah, you asked me to make the question easy. I'm a little more worried about that now.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a tricky one.
So, Mark, what have you got?
Okay, so in an attempt to soup up our social life a little bit, I have made this question considerably more answerable in the hope that we can share a beer with some of our listeners at the Gatasm. So, there is an English-born physician who worked in America and is widely credited as being the father of medical ultrasound. What I want to know is, he won a prize for his work in ultrasound. How much money did he win?
Okay, that sounds not...
That sounds like we're going to owe people drinks.
Yeah, that does sound like we're going to owe people drinks.
Yeah.
Which is okay. So, thanks very much for that. We look forward to hearing all the correct answers whispered in our ear on Wednesday night.
One free beer per listener. Is this where we do the fast talking terms and conditions? Only draft watery European lager will be supplied.
Oh, I was going to say, probably the more umbrellas that you order in your drink, the better.
Or maybe, as Glasgow themed, it should be a pint of Tennent Super.
Nice. That is exactly what we should do.
Just one hit of heroin, really. Is it
so
time
Bex,
for me? Yes.
Yeah, so Bex, why don't you bring it back round and finish off our ultrasound themed podcast.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the use of gastric ultrasound scanning in anaesthetic practice. And looking it up online, I found the first article printed in 1992 by Karp et al, and that was from Anesthesia Analgesia. After that 1992 article, there wasn't really much in the literature. But the last couple of years, there's been a resurgence of studies appearing, and there's two main groups. There's Bouvet in France, and then there's Perlis and Chan in Toronto. And during the evolvement of gastric ultrasound scanning, people have tried to visualize different parts of the stomach. Now, the fundus seems to be the most difficult to visualize. Then the body is a bit unreliable, but the antrum has been found to be the easiest. And I think this is because the position that they put patients in is the right lateral decubitus position. And so because of gravity, fluid moves down to the dependent areas, and this gives a good view. So to scan the stomach, what people are using is the 2 to 5 megahertz curvilinear probe, and they put it in the epigastric area in the parasagittal plane. And then your landmarks that you use are the left lobe of the liver, the superior mesenteric vein, the inferior vena cava, and the pancreas. And when you get a decent view, then there's two ways that it can be described. There's a qualitative view and a quantitative view. For the qualitative view, there's three different ways. So first you can describe the antrum as being starved, and that it looks flat, and the anterior and posterior walls are completely opposed to each other, or it might form a sort of ovoid bull's eye shape. Then if you get your patient to ingest some liquid, the posterior wall gets pushed backwards and the antrum becomes rounded. If you're scanning just as the person's finished swallowing, you get what they call the starry night appearance. And that's because you get small bubbles mixed up with the liquid from swallowing. And then if you scan a few minutes later, the air has risen up to the less dependent areas and you get a nice sort of homogeneous hypoechoic look. And then when someone's eaten a solid meal, so they seem to always choose a tuna sandwich for some reason in the literature, they get a frosted glass appearance.
Oh, the chicken of the sea.
Exactly. And they get this frosted glass. So when, as you've been chewing and you've been swallowing, you get gas mixed in. Now, the group that is led by Perlis in 2011, he put forward this grading system for this qualitative view. And he describes a grade naught stomach as one where the antrum is empty when the patient is lying both supine and in the right lateral decubitus position. Then a grade one view is when you only see fluid in the antrum when the patient is lying on their side. And then a grade two view is when you see fluid in both positions. And this is what he puts forward as a risky stomach, so a patient that's at increased risk of aspiration. The other way of describing the antrum when you look at it with ultrasound is the quantitative view. Now, this seems to me quite a lot more labor intensive, and they measure the cross-sectional area of the antrum. And it's a formula that was used by Bolondi, and everyone else has picked it up, and it's the cross-sectional area equal to the anteroposterior diameter multiplied by the craniocaudal diameter multiplied by pi divided by 4. Now, for the average adult, they say that a
Please tell me there is an app for that.
There's bound to be. It'll probably only be for the iPhone, but we'll see. So, yeah, for an average adult, a cross-sectional area of 340 millimeters squared is what they consider to be an at-risk stomach. In some of the studies, they took volunteers and they took them from a starved state to having drunk 500 mils and scanned them sort of sequentially. And in between 0 and 300 mils of fluid being ingested, there's a really good linear relationship between the gastric volume and the cross-sectional area, up until about 300 mils. And then once a person's drunk more than 300 mils, that relationship deviates, and it's because the antrum is already maximally distended. So the fluid then just fills up the more proximal areas of the stomach, and the antrum actually can't get any bigger. Then there's some very, very complex formulas described, which I'm not going to reel off. But that allows you to work out the volume of fluid ingested if you don't know the patient, how much they've drunk, for a given cross-sectional area. And it's from animal studies, they've used some monkeys, and the data extrapolated from that suggests that if you have a gastric content volume of more than 0.8 mils per kilo, you're at a higher risk of active aspiration. So if you've, you know, intubated someone while they're light and there's been coughing and straining. But people to actually be at a frank risk of passive aspiration, you need probably about 200 mils in the stomach. Now, as a science, I think it's just evolving, so I get some of the other skills we've been discussing. And as a standalone tool, it's not going to be your magic bullet to protect you against aspiration as a complication. I think in light of the numbers that we got from the fourth national audit project from the Royal College of Anaesthetists, which shows that aspiration accounts for about 9% of all anaesthetic deaths, it may be a useful tool just to help us make clinical decisions in the future. What do you guys think?
So how is it going to change your practice?
I think from doing an emergency list point of view, quite often you get a patient, the surgical SHO tries to negotiate with you what a well-set and circumscribed kind of starvation thing. They're like, well, the thing is, it was a really light breakfast. He just had cornflakes, and it was 4 hours ago, all this kind of stuff. And you're just like, listen, rules are rules. Jog on, mate. But I always feel that there's a certain equilibrium that has to be met between the urgency of surgery and when they last had something to eat and drink and what is strictly reasonable. And we've got a protocol to attend to that particular circumstance, and that's the rapid sequence intubation, of which there is a very limited evidence base for anyway.
Rapid sequence induction. But we can't leave that in. That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I spend all my time hammering that out of A&E trainees, so
oh, that's embarrassing, for shame. Yeah. I'll probably have to take that right out. But anyway, you do need something to kind of to make that equilibrium, something that's a bit more science-based. So I think it would be useful if someone said to you, well, we've got this patient that we could sneak on to the end of the list. It would be great if we could do them. And you've got this very archaic starvation law. If you could do a quick ultrasound scan and say, hey, listen, you've got a cross-sectional area there of less than 200 mils or whatever you said it was of fluid. So to be honest, the risk is X, and let's just crack on with it. I think that'd be kind of useful.
That's what I think. And those patients that, you know, they were at the pub last night, they had a huge pie and chips, they were on their way home, and then they had this car accident, and then they've been in hospital overnight, but they had pain straight after they'd eaten, and they've had a whole lot of opioids. And then you get to that, are they ever starved argument, where you could just scan them and say, actually, their stomach is empty or their stomach is not.
Right.
It would just give you a guide, wouldn't it?
I suppose you just need to make sure the trauma is going to prevent them from lying in the right decubitus position.
Yeah, possibly.
Piss off, Frank.
That's a good point.
I think you heard it here first.
We certainly did, and we should probably move on to our final segment, Biology or Bunkum. So, for this episode's Biology or Bunkum, your three news stories are: number one, drinking coffee is good for your health. A new study indicates that drinking 2 to 3 cups of coffee a day can decrease your risk of death by up to 13%. Number two, emo haircuts may lead to a lazy eye epidemic. Haircuts where the fringe covers up one eye are acting like an eye patch, blocking sensory input, and ophthalmologists are seeing an increase in cases of amblyopia that need correcting. Number three, a hospital in Texas has declared a war on fatties by announcing it's not going to hire any staff who are overweight, which they're defining as a BMI of over 35. So, I can't remember who won last week.
I won.
You did. And therefore, you should go first, Bex.
I think number three is bunkum, because I can't imagine in the States that they have enough workers with a BMI under 35 to staff a whole hospital. I think they will have to include people over 35. Yeah. I think Texas is supposed to be one of the fattest states. And so, I just don't think they'll have the workforce that are of decent weight.
Mark, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I'm afraid I have to agree with Bex for similar reasons, and that I don't know much about American employment policy, but in this country you wouldn't be allowed to do that because you would be discriminating against somebody's lifestyle choice.
Fair enough. And Frank?
Well, it seems that this time, I can't remember this having happened for a while, we're all in agreement. I very much want the second one to be true. Oh, I think that's a great story. And as an avid coffee drinker, insist that the first one is true.
Yeah, let's hope so.
With regards to the third one, I don't know about our policy in this country. I'm sure there's a policy about not calling people with unhealthy lifestyles fatties. As apparently on an internationally distributed podcast. But
I'm not judging, just reading what it says on the news story.
Apparently we're not allowed, you're not allowed to call them obese either anymore. I read that in the Daily Mail recently. Despite, yeah, so now you've got to call them unhealthy weight. That's what you're allowed to call them.
Oh, that's much worse.
Yeah. Apparently you can't be called morbidly obese. Doctors, GPs have got to talk to you about your unhealthy
weight. That really winds me up, given that these are scientifically defined terms. They're not at all subjective or emotional.
But Rick, I think your story about cuddly fun people in the States has got to be bunkum.
Okay, so everybody pitching for number three. So, in an order, we'll go with number one first, which both Frank and I are pleased to learn that drinking coffee is indeed good for your health. This is an article for all the people who are far more academic than the rest of us who do read Neejum. This was in Neejum in May, and a new study indicates that drinking two or three cups of coffee a day does indeed decrease your risk of death by 10% if you're a man and 13% if you're a woman over the time frame they were looking at over that particular cohort. What was really interesting about this piece of work, and it's kind of a stats thing again, but they were looking at the amount of coffee you drunk at one point in time, then following you up, it was a decade and a bit later, I think, and seeing whether or not you died, basically. And those who did drink more coffee did have a much higher mortality rate, but when you adjusted the stats for the fact that more people who drank coffee also smoked, and you took smoking out of the equation, you found that coffee seemed to actually have a health benefit, which is fantastic. So for those of us who are like me and Frank, who don't smoke and do drink a fair amount of coffee, looks like that's probably good for your health.
Unless, of course, you have a full fat latte with extra cream and chocolate sprinkles. And then you can forget working for Texas Hospital.
Well, you're not going to be employed, but you are going to live slightly longer, apparently. So that is totally biology. So, number two, the emo haircuts. That is the bunkum, I'm afraid. Oh. Making you all completely wrong. So this was an article that came through, I think it was Gizmodo on Twitter, but some Australian optometrist, which I'm not sure, is that an ophthalmologist or is that an optician?
That's an optician.
Is an optician.
Well, I don't know, it might be a separate thing altogether.
Well, some guy who's an executive member of the Optometrist Association of Australia has said that having lopsided bangs, which is in keeping with the emo hairstyle, creates a form of eye patch which blocks sensory input, which is what you actually do for this condition called amblyopia, or lazy eye, I think is what we normally call it, which you use to strengthen the normally dominant eye. And the prevalence of these emo style haircuts is causing an outbreak of amblyopia. However, that has been refuted as utter bunkum by some people who seem to have proper medical degrees. There is a fantastic article which we'll link to, and the reason the article is fantastic is twofold. Number one, because there's a bunch of photos of people with hilarious haircuts, which is well worth a look, and there's a video link which shows you just how bad it is to have an emo haircut and does some kind of 3D CGI brain science showing how half your brain shuts down because you like to listen to Fall Out Boy. So have a look at that. That was this month's bunkum. A hospital in Texas has indeed declared war on fatties and has said that it's not going to hire any staff who are overweight. Bex, as you pointed out, it would seem ridiculous, but the Citizens Medical Center in Texas has said they will not employ people with a BMI of over 35. And constitutionally, they're allowed to do that. So that is biology.
There'll be a follow-up article saying they've shut in a few years' time.
Probably. Well, be that as it may, we better wrap up this extraordinarily long podcast. Not entirely sure how I'm going to do that.
You say that whatever your BMI, you're always welcome to listen to Gascast.
Make some other gattism.
Exactly. So thank you very much for that, Mark. And we will be back next month live from the GAT annual scientific meeting in Glasgow.
Not live recorded.
No, it's not live recorded. Thank you. but we look forward to hopefully sharing a pint with some of you there. We'll have some great features and interviews, and we're really looking forward to it. So thanks very much for listening.
Bye-bye. Oh shit, we don't do that anymore.
It's Blue Peter, you're not allowed to.
It's getting